Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight we have another episode of the Centre Circle. And we're also expecting a guest who is rejoining us for a second time where we can chat about a second book that he's done. But before we do that, I would just like to introduce my usual compadres for such an event. First of all, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks, Stu. I'm looking forward to the return visit of our guest tonight and discussing his book. So, yeah, it's going to be a nice hour's chat about football.
Yeah, these are the ones. These are the ones that I absolutely love. These are right down my alley, these ones.
Absolutely.
And second of all, obviously, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you?
We're very well, thank you, Stuart. How are we doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm almost nailed on that this is going to be right down your street as well.
Oh, it's preaching to the choir. It really is. It's going to be a good hour of just general agreement, I think.
It is. Misty-eyed reminiscing, I think, is what we'll title this one. Yes. Okay, so tonight, in the centre circle, returning, like I say, Mr. Daniel Gray. Dan's had 8 books published and written for various newspapers and magazines. Also undertakes copywriting jobs for print and online and screenwriting work ranging from BBC documentaries to online advertising videos. Hopefully you'll remember from before, he joined us on a previous edition of the Centre Circle to discuss his book Black Boots and Football Pinks, which was just a fantastically wonderful nostalgic ramble through so many of the great things about football in the past. Today we're bringing it all forward in time by focusing on his book Saturday 3 p.m. In which Dan explains, illustrates with entrancing pictures, which painted with words, that today's game isn't all that bad, not by a long way, or as many as would have us believe. So, Dan, welcome for a second time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to hear you, all three of you, again.
Thank you very much. As like I say, as always, you know, we love getting the authors on, love giving them opportunity to chat about the book. And I think we've almost done it in reverse order, really, haven't we? Because, you know, this book came out before Black Boots and the Football Pinks, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It's me that's done it in reverse order, really. I should have thought of them the other way around. I should have done the good old days and then the present days. But yeah, that's just the way it happened. That's the way it occurred in my brain, unfortunately.
That's all right. We'll just take anything that comes along. Don't worry about that. And obviously, like you've said, you've sort of almost done them. You've sort of done them back to front. Before we get on to chatting about this book, I suppose the first question then was, which one did you prefer? The one a nostalgic look back, or one that looks at the present day game?
Well, I'd like to give a sort of on-the-fence answer and give both cases, but really, I'm still stuck in the past. So it's the game circa about 1993 to 1998 that I love the most. And there is so much I love, as we'll discuss, about the modern game. But, yeah, I can't lie. I can't give some political on-the-fence answer and say, well, I would go back if I had the chance. There's a sort of sweet spot for me where you had much of the good of the old game and some of the nicer things about the modern game, not least safe, feeling quite safe at games, not having urine trickling down the terrace. There was a sort of sweet spot in the mid to late 90s that I think I would go back there, because it felt like sort of almost like the early days of the Premier League, really, for the first 5 years, where you had quite a lot of the old world, but not too many of the awful elements.
it's very, I mean, obviously, I'm going to ask Stephen and Gary as well, sort of their thoughts, I suppose, on, having read both books and, their sort of take on football past, present. But before, I'm going to have my say first. So I think I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, for me, my sweet spot, as you so rightly put it, is probably from about 82 to about 96. It extends quite a way and it straddles the Premier League. But I think part of it is because some of it belongs to my childhood, which, you know, we've chatted about this. I've lost count of how many times we chat about it, and certainly Gary and Stephen and I do. Certainly when we're looking at World Cups or, you know, FA Cup finals or European Cup finals, it's always the ones that sort of that go across your childhood that almost seem to stick in the memory most. I think for me, the football experience and anything related to it from my childhood, I could almost relate to it better than I probably can more of the modern game, I think. And I feel quite lucky, really, that I've managed to sort of straddle, I suppose, like you mentioned as well, the Premier League era. You know, I can certainly remember football pre-Premier League. I can appreciate, you know, the moments when it started to shift and change, and I can, you know, appreciate the modern game as it sits and stands today. It's funny, you know, you're right, it's a perfect way to describe it. You know, you have this sweet spot, those years where football just seemed to be perfect for you at that time. I suppose, Gary, you know, yeah,
you
obviously
get right about all it was. There's something as well, sorry, before you go on, being able to straddle both those worlds, isn't there? Sort of, I feel quite privileged that I've been able to know both in a way. It really feels that if you're born in a certain, whether it's from the 70s to the early 80s, you're going to have known all football and new and you, as you say, the sweet spot, the in-between years for me. Yeah,
it is, and it's funny. I'm really sorry, Stephen and Gary. I've not forgotten you there. I promise. I promise. I'll ask you a question. I knew this is hard for you. I teach and I try and get football into my lessons as much, well, more than I probably should, and trying to sort of talk to them and educate them about pre-Premier League football, I might as well just be teaching them maths or physics. There just seems to be no comprehension, sort of, you know, with many of them about what football was like, you know, what football was like pre-Premier League. You know, they really struggle sometimes to really comprehend. And so even some of the things in the book, you know, that we're going to talk about, you know, tonight, even some of those are almost beyond their comprehension, let alone, you know, the previous book. But you're right, I think it almost is a privilege that we straddle that 1992 sort of definitive moment, you know, in the game, you know, certainly for me, in this country. So Gary, your take on it, sorry.
Oh, it's okay, buddy. I think, you know, Dan has a wonderful way with words, and we use the phrase painting the picture with these words in the book, and, you know, straddling the age, I think, is a wonderful way of saying it, of describing it. I mean, I sort of, being the age, my first memory of football is the early 60s, so I can go back quite a long way. I like both the sort of modern game and the game in the past for different reasons. And I guess at these football times, we tend to indulge in a lot of nostalgia. We write about things, particularly in the past. And then there's also sort of a charge to be levied against when we write about those sort of things that you're looking back to roast into glasses. And if you know, that's almost a little bit okay if you do those things. But I think it's a bit like the difference between classical music and music of the day today. You know, I mean, you can like both, and it doesn't mean, you know, you dislike the other because you like one of them. So I think, you know, having an ability to straddle the ages equivalent with football, I think is a great joy and a privilege.
Stephen, you know, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think you've covered it really well there. I mean, you know, I agree that, you know, being able to see the old and new has been a wonderful thing. I just wish I'd seen more of the old, you know, because hopefully I'm still going to get another 30 or 40 or whatever years of life to be able to watch a lot more new football. But I'd have loved to have seen more of the 70s, you know, a child of the 70s, grew up on the stories of those teams and those, you know, not just my own team, but the, you know, the teams of everyone else. And I'd have loved to have, you know, I often think, you know, how great it would be to have a time machine to go back and watch games from the 50s and 60s and before. So I feel slightly robbed that the new age came maybe a decade too soon, you know, but so, you know, a lot of this book, you know, really, really speaks to me. It's great, but yeah, for me, that talk about defining ages and the sweet spot, You know, I started to look askance at football as soon as kind of like squad numbers were introduced. That was the tipping point for me. You know, football has constantly been looked at, you know, askance ever since. And I'm not saying there's no beauty in it now. There's some great beauty in it. There's some wonderful, wonderful stuff. But yeah, I've had a, you know, a little bit of a standoff in football ever since squad numbers were introduced.
I think from what I'm gathering there, then really anybody whose life, where the actual middle year of their entire life is 1992, is the perfect age, isn't it? From that.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean,
if you can live for 70 years,
yeah, that's it.
35 afterwards.
You have around about a 12-month span where they dispense with the back pass rule and introduce squad numbers, and football's never recovered since.
Brilliant.
With somebody who's middle sort of their age is the mid 70s. I might sort of just dispute that a little bit, but I take your point.
All right, so, well, I'll tell you what, Dan, obviously it's your book, so you're in charge. In terms of chapters, then, I mean, they're all, you know, they're incredible, all 50 of them, and every single one. I mean, I was reading it and sort of smiling and a bit laughing, and you know, and people are like, what you're laughing at, and you try and explain it to people what you're laughing at, and unless they are as obsessed as you are with the game, they just go, oh, right. And it's like, no, it's funnier than that. Or you have to, and then you try and explain it, and the more you explain it, the more they just think, yeah, no, I'm not getting it. So I'm really pleased that the four of us are going to be together for an hour, because I'm desperate to get it out. But to begin with, Dan, do you have a favourite chapter from the 50?
Well, it changes all the time. I mean, the book came about because I was in one of those really disillusioned periods with the game. It was just when the FA or whoever was in charge had announced that the FA Cup third round would be held over 5 days. And I sank into those periods I get where I just think I can't be bothered with this anymore. And I just started to make this list. And 50 I had in my mind, and I actually came up with 70, and I've come up with many, many more since. So, but yes, the favourites change all the time. But at the moment, I was looking through the list, obviously knowing we were going to be talking, and it's the one called "Listening to the Results in the Car," because it's one where we've used that word "straddle" a lot already. But that it maintains its power today. It's rare that me and my dad go by car these days, but if we still do, and if we're in the car and I still can't drive, so my dad's still driving me everywhere, and it's Charlotte Green, you know, it's not James Alexander Gordon, but it's the same. The results being whispered to us inside the car, in a traffic jam, having been at the match, you know, pissed off, jubilant, whatever we are, it's the same. The condensation on the windows, the beauty of the voice, you feeling like the voice is telling you, giving you all of those tidings from Grimsby and Torquay and everywhere. And so I feel really still a great connection is brought to me from that experience. So today's answer will be the chapter called "Listening to the Results in the Car."
It's funny when I was reading that one, and you mentioned at the end how there'll be thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people doing exactly the same thing all around the country. Everyone will be doing exactly, like you say, what you're technically doing in that car as well. It's almost like it's one of those moments where you know what everybody who is like you is doing at that exact time. For those sort of 5 or 10 minutes, you, like you say, it steamed up windows, the cold, trying to get dry, and the sort of, as results come through, and you think, oh, that's a big result, or oh, that's going to have repercussions, or oh, that's that, you know, and you almost apply another piece of information. Well, I do it anyway. You apply a piece of information to the result, even though it's not been said. You've just been given a score, but you instantly you apply an additional piece of subtext to go alongside, yes, the result,
oh,
that you've
absolutely
heard.
And just picturing it's that thing of it feeling so intensely individual and for you, but knowing it's communal, that's the essence of it that I absolutely adore. And I suppose when I look back at the book, some of the chapters I cherish more are experienced with my dad. There's one called "Going with Dad," and as I mentioned in the previous podcast, I go with my daughter now, so it's not just about men together. You know, people go to football with different people in different ways. But this book, when I look back, there's one called "Jimmy Armfield's Voice." Of course, that's the one of the 50 that doesn't count now because we lost Jimmy Armfield.
Yeah.
But very Jimmy Armfield's voice is synonymous with being in with my dad in the car, and I'm privileged enough to still be able to do that, of course.
I mean, Stephen, you know, you can go next. I'm sure we're going to pick more than one each. For you, you know, what's your sort of number one topic from this treasure trove?
I can just go back to Dan's there. I'd also throw in the random man with the transistor radio as well as part of that. You know, that great joy of kind of like finding the results.
Yeah.
On the car radio, but it's hearing that snapshot of a result or a goal being scored. Because someone would always have one of those handheld, battery-powered, you know, transistors attached to the ears, and that's another great joy. But yeah, I'd just throw in a story about my dad and his brother from the late 1960s, about 68 or 69, a Liverpool-Leicester game, and they played football in the morning, and then they skimmed into Anfield 10 minutes after kickoff. Went into the old paddock, the old Archibald Leach main stand paddock, and they didn't bother asking what the score was. Just stood there, watched what they thought was a goalless draw. Couldn't understand why at the end of the match everyone's kind of like saying, "Great, great, that's a great result." Got back to the car, found out that we'd won 3-0. So yeah, complete lack of communication, but yeah, he still keeps on coming out with that story every now and then to embarrass his brother.
Brilliant.
But yeah, no, another one, a great one for me was the local lads coming through. That was a really good one because from a Liverpool perspective as well, there were very few local lads throughout the 1980s that came through, from kind of like Samuel Lee in the late 70s to Gary Ablett in the late 80s, there were very few Liverpool products that made it through. Some very, very good players, but they didn't make it. Dave Watson, you know, Kevin Sheedy was bought from Hereford, but went into the reserves. Alan Harp was another one. And, you know, so many of these players went off and excelled elsewhere. But it was a rarity for a Liverpool player to break through from the reserves into the first team. I think we had a player called Mark Seagraves who played like a... He played a couple of cup games deputising for Gary Gillespie in 85-86, the double winning year he played in something like the League Cup semi-final and an FA Cup third round game. Never ever played a league game in his life for us, and then kind of like he moved on and went nomadic. But it was that concept of, from a Liverpool perspective, was that when kids came through, when they did make it, they were given a harder time than those from outside the area. So, you know, if a header was lost, they were booed, not booed, but barracked more, you know, criticised more for the mistakes and the shortcomings than a player would who was brought in from outside the area. And it used to drive me nuts. It used to drive me absolutely nuts to the point that, you know, I'd be the one like over applauding, you know, a simple pass by them. And it was, yeah. And yeah, that one just struck a real chord and just brought so much back about all that. That era of kind of like local players being given harder times. It was only when Fowler and Gerrard and McManaman came through that, you know, local players were kind of like revered and celebrated for what they should be. But yeah, there was that concept in the 80s. It was almost like these local players that did sneak through, they were carrying kind of like the dreams of everyone. So it was kind of like, that's what my dream is, that's what our dream is. To be out there on the pitch, and if they weren't deemed good enough, it was kind of like that inner concept that maybe people felt that they could do better than the players that were going out onto the pitch in their name from their city. But it was a bewildering concept to give the local lads such a hard time.
It's an interesting perspective that you would assume that, you know, a local player there'd be more patience, you know, with the local lad, there'd be more affinity and more almost given more time, almost forgiven more. But that's quite interesting, that.
But no, it went the opposite way for a period of time. It went completely the opposite way. I'm not sure if that was the way in the 60s when the likes of Tommy Smith came through and Chris Lawler. Ian Callaghan, there were so many that came through and excelled and did really, really well. But then, as the 70s progressed, and players like David Fairclough, who, you know, had these spikes of achievement, but offset by periods of time out of the team and not playing, and then he would return, and it was just a slight indifference started to creep in. Especially when the Scots did so well, kind of like we brought Dalglish in and Dalglish, Souness, Hansen became the watchword of quality, really, in that Liverpool team, that local lads became so much more scrutinised. And yeah, it just brought so much back.
I mean, Gary, you know, there's loads, isn't there? You know, in this 50, I think, like we've said, and I'm sure we'll continue, you know, you can relate to every single one. I mean, I think I've changed my mind in the last 10 minutes about what I'm going to pick. But yeah. Gary, for you, you know, what sort of immediately jumped out at you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much the same. I mean, I reviewed the game this morning, and then we'll be on after reading it a few days ago. And I changed my mind a couple of times, but I want to go with getting the fixture list because there's a little bit of magic about that. you know, and this summer's a good example of what Dan mentions in the book, that it's one of those summers where there's no tournament. And it's going to be that sort of the first couple of days is going to be fine, it's holiday. And then you're going to be thinking, I miss football really bad, and it's going to be a bad sort of time before it comes back. And it's going to be 2 months, which is going to seem like 2 bloody years. And he mentions about when the fixture list comes out, and there's a wonderful phrase, it's like a lasso cast towards a golden August. And it's almost like, I know exactly what you mean, you can throw that lasso and you pull August towards you, because it becomes real, and it's much more sort of almost tangible then when you've got that fixture list and you know the games that are coming up. And another phrase he's got in the chapter is about, because ahead of the league season starting now, the domestic season starting, the cup games or league games, you've got these ridiculous amounts of pre-season friendlies and continental tours and you know, where players who are never going to play for you again get games. And you know, and he calls them the beige pre-season friendlies. I think that's absolutely right, because they're almost sepia. You know, they're not real, and almost double plastic. And when you get the league fixtures, the you sort of look at, and Dan mentioned about, you know, who you got first. Well, I always actually do the other thing. I always look at who I've got last.
Yeah.
Who's the last 4 or 5 games? If we stop for get some points, are we going to end up going to Liverpool and Man City, or have we got, you know, Burnley and I don't know, I can't even remember. Example, Burnley and Huddersfield at home. So I mean, it brings next season a little bit closer to you. And it becomes touchable. It becomes touchable, and everything's fresh. It's like a white piece of paper without any ink on it yet. Everything's forgiven from last season. You start from scratch. I think actually Dan uses that phrase in the chapter. And all things are possible. You can win the league. You can win the FA Cup. You can win the League Cup. You can win the boat race. You believe all those things are possible, and that's the door that the fixture list unlocks.
I've always liked as well the idea that you know what mood you're going to be in on that exact day in March. When you support a team like Middlesbrough, you know, if you're looking at Man United away, you already know what your face is going to be like that night. I find that strangely comforting, and I don't know why.
Well, but you could do it month to month as well. You could gauge just how anxious you are going to be in various months of the year. You'd see a cluster of really tricky fixtures in February. I think I'm going to be kind of like a little bit panicky throughout February, and then then you look at another and think, oh, there must be an international break there, so they're going 3 fixtures and they don't look too bad. I'm going to really enjoy March, and you know, it was great. You could set your internal mood clock by the fixture list.
It just makes everything real again. You know, it gives you hope, and it gives you it makes your expectations become a little more raw almost. You know, because it becomes real again. There, next season sounds a long while, because every football fans have this sort of lament. You know, well, there's always next season. You know, well, next season, but always next season. But when you get that fixture list, it almost becomes that season. It's the season. It's not next season anymore. It's real now. So, I mean, there's a little bit of magic about that. And when I read that, I thought that really sort of grasped me, that, you know, it's it is the magic of the fixture list.
It's funny, actually, Gary. We say that when you go to you always went to the last game or the last 4 or 5 games, and obviously, you know, Hull City haven't spent that many times in the Premier League, but whenever their fixtures came out, the last game of the season, as an ultimate pessimist, the last game of the season was, who do we need 3 points off to stay up? And I can remember,
who do we need to beat 9-0?
Yeah, and the first season was Manchester United at the KC, and I can remember thinking, we need to be safe before then. And it was, and then the next part was they won't even send out a half decent team. They'll have been relegated. They'll be in major finals. They'll send a weakened team. I won't even get the best version of Manchester United in that particular. And I was distraught. I was absolutely distraught with the last game of the season of Hull City's first season in the Premier League, which seems, because it was their first ever season. And yet, as soon as I got the fixed list, I was like, oh, brilliant. That's it. And yeah. as you were saying about the optimism, Gary, my pessimism had kicked. It was like, season's starting already. We've got to beat Man United to stay up. And that was how I'd seen the season.
This is one of the key draws of the book is that each of these sort of chapters, as the one Steve's mentioned already, you know, that, and the one Dan mentioned, of course, they all sort of give. It resonates with you. It makes sense if you're a football fan. You understand that it triggers that little you nod or thinking, yeah, okay, I've got that one. So, for any football fan, you're reading those, all 50 will mean something to you.
Absolutely. I mean, I've changed my mind that many times. I think my favourite one, and it's more almost like an, again, I suppose a bit like an obsession, is the visiting a ground for the first time. I am obsessed with football grounds. Well, stadiums of any sort, but ideally football stadiums, and I will go to any length, to anywhere, just to, on any training course. If it's going to be held at a football ground, I'm there. I don't care what the training's in. I don't care if it's relevant to my professional career in any way. If there's a training course to be held at a football ground, I'm there. And it's, I love the setting that they're in, first of all. So, this one's in the middle of a housing estate. This one's, you know, it's new, it's an industrial estate. And like I say, Hull City's in a park, which is great. And I love seeing where they are, first of all, their geographical location within the city. Yeah. And then from there, I have this, again, an obsession. I try and see it, and you can't do it so much now. With the corners being filled in the grounds, but that sneaking, having a look through the gate, to have a look through the corner, to see onto the pitch, that almost that like first sneaky peek, if you like, of the inside of the ground. If you've never been before, it's, oh, can I just see through that little gap? Can I just see just a little corner of the ground of what it might look like? And then, for me, obviously, the ultimate is when you're on the concourse and you go through and out, and the stadium is just, you know, it's almost like a big welcome for you, you know, that it's there with its outreached arms sort of welcoming you. And I went to Grimsby Towns Ground for the first time last year. Don't expect too much, you've been at the KCOM and this and that, don't expect, but I absolutely loved it because it was such an old, or is an old fashioned, old style football ground. And I went through, and it's sort of four stands that don't match. One of them still is, there's a lot of wood involved, and it's got, part of it's got cement around the base of it so far up. And then one's all sitting like, oh, that's the posh stand. And you look at it and think, oh, really? But it's the fact that it's so eclectic and so different, and the pitch is so uneven, but it's still, to me, it's still a thing of beauty. I think football grounds for me are the most beautiful buildings to be in, doesn't go down well with a lot of people. but I'm kind of hoping that you three get it. But I would go anywhere to go to a football stadium. And I'm not picking two, but obviously the very first, when you're seeing a ground from the train, I absolutely crane my neck. My sister lives in London. My eldest daughter's living down there at uni as well. And because we go from Hull to King's Cross, we go straight past the Emirates, literally with almost within touching distance. Yeah. But you can still see Highbury and the stand that was left. And every time on the way in and the way out, do I desperately look to see that what's left of Highbury, more than the Emirates. And it's just it's just an obsession that I have with just seeing them. Just seeing football grounds.
You know, I was thinking of picking that chapter for my own favourite, because I thought when I was writing it that it was the geekiest thing and that everyone would just make fun of me. But it turns out loads of us do it. Yeah. And I've had that many conversations on Twitter. People send them to me on Twitter when they go past the ground. I've had so many shots at London Road because of the East Coast Main Line, as people do. And then the question of on which line can you see most grounds is a good one as well. I favour... there's a brilliant line that goes from Newcastle down to Middlesbrough, but along the coast, the Coal Coast line, they call it. And you see six on that, I've counted. And so, yeah, I've been amazed with how much that has struck a chord with people. The other day, though, my mate trumped everything because he went past Starks Park, Raith Rovers, and the team were training on the pitch, and that has beaten everything I've ever seen before.
Yeah, wow. I've never travelled past a ground when a game's been on ever. I've never been that lucky.
No, I think I'm sort of glad I haven't, because when I'm aware of a game being on, if I'm anywhere near it, I just feel this terrible sense that I should be in the ground and that I'm wasting my life if I'm not there.
Yeah, how dare the game be going on?
Exactly.
I mean, we know we'll pick another chat. You know, we're definitely going to go through another chat as well. But before we do that, did you say you had about 70, 75 down originally?
Yeah, and whittled them down, or some didn't quite work, or weren't universal enough, I suppose. Oh, yeah.
Right. So I was going to ask you. Well, I was going to ask you two questions. One was, can you give us an idea of what didn't go in, but also how did you select the 50?
I can't remember how I selected them, and I definitely pulled a few out that weren't working, and I can't even remember what they were now. So I could find the paperwork somewhere, I'm sure. But ones that might be too similar to what's in there. So having this conversation now, I'm thinking there was one called being in an empty football ground, because that's a bit of a weird hobby of mine. But especially in Scotland, like you say, if you're sent somewhere with a job or whatever, most of the grounds are open still. So I was recently down in Dumfries, and Queen of the South is one of my favourite grounds anyway, Palmerston. Gates were wide open, and I was just wandering around the main stand, and I was thinking, hanging around a football ground on a Tuesday afternoon, this is my kind of tourism.
Yeah.
And so that was one of them. But there was a decision process. If something was a bit similar to something else, I didn't want too much repetition, which is a danger. But it won't stop me if I can get a book deal. It won't stop me doing a book called, you know. I could tell you that the folder on my computer is called Tuesday 7:45 p.m. So that 50 more delights of football. So I'll hold some of them back. But yeah, I've had a couple of texts in the last week of people that have been flying off places and looking at grounds from the air. One of my mates went to Barcelona and saw six grounds on the way back to Edinburgh. I just thought it was tremendous. So you can see where that one was going.
Yeah. Do you have anybody that you run the ideas of your 50 by, or are these purely your thoughts, your 50? No, and I mean live or die by them, but you know, are they you know yours, or do you seek any sort of secondary opinion on any of these?
Do you know, I didn't, which is why I probably worried about the book going out and everyone going, what's he on about? I just tend to sit in my little room and whirring through my brain. I don't consult. I can't say that I have a muse or anything apart from the cat, really, and he's not very interested. So it's in there. Well, it's in there all the time, looking for a way out, as Nick Hornby puts it in Fever Pitch, and I suppose this was a way out. So yeah, no muse, no one to run them off. I'm just glad they've struck a chord.
Oh, brilliant! Even that just makes it even better. That just makes it even better that they are just purely 100% yours. That's even better.
It's therapy. It's therapy. I think.
Stephen, obviously, you know, have you got another one, or do you want to sort of talk us through two or three maybe that sort of strike a chord? I'm kind of trying to set the scene that I've got for you.
You really could kind of like just spree on this. I mean, you could go through every single chapter. But yeah, brackets and score lines, you know, for instance, you know, it just brings the whole Vidi printer back, you know, and the sound of the Vidi printer as well. That'll do. And then, you know, Des Lineman or whoever, you know, reading the scores out. But yeah, that whole shame of conceding enough goals to need it right in you know, in non-numerical terms. And you know,
I really struggled to get an answer on what the definition was. Was it 8 or 7? You know, do you know what I mean? When do they employ it? I googled that one, because I don't tend to google much. I try to rely on my head, but there isn't like a Sky Sports policy or a BBC policy on seven merits. I think I can't remember what I decided on, 8, I think. 7 or 8, maybe, anyway.
I think so. 7 or 8, but it was just that, you know, there'd be a sharp and take a breath.
Yes.
Ooh. 7, they've conceded enough goals to require brackets. and the actual spelling out of eight, you know, it was just a yeah. That just kind of like brought out like a big, huge, massive smile from me. I thought that was brilliant, and yeah, again, like so many of the chapters are just really, really evocative. It's, you know, it's watching in bad weather, the need for an orange ball, you know, and just little things that you miss, you know, and it just comes back to, you know, the fact that the Premier League will now have a winter and a summer ball. You know, and it's crap. You know, just stop doing that. Just bring out an orange ball when it's white enough to need one.
You know, Gary, yourself, you know, is, you know, like I mean, Stephen's right. You know, we could list them all, to be fair, and make this a really long sort of 24-hour chat. But you know, for yourself, you know, which other ones in particular strike a chord?
Well, I want to sort of amalgamate two very briefly and then tell you what my other choice would be. So the two I want to amalgamate very, very briefly is hitting the bar, the sound of the ball hitting the bar, and I'm watching youth football, a game of youth football in the park. Many years ago, I used to work at excavation site, a quarry, and there was a school backed onto it, and quite often the school playing field backed onto the road where the quarry was. And the school kids be playing football quite often when we're going home, and quite often I'd stand there and just watch them for a bit. And the school that was near to us, they used to wear white shirts, black shorts, but the visiting team were wearing blue and white Everton colours. And I was sort of, the way the pitch orientated, I was behind one of the goals, as it were. And there's a corner at the far end, and the home team were attacking. The ball got cleared, and this little kid, I suppose he'd be maybe 14 or so, that sort of age, 14, 15. And he's one of the smallest players on there. And the ball sort of came out, and he was free. And he was sort of like, I don't know, perhaps halfway inside his own half. Nobody around him. And this kid is legging it like Mariel to get to the other end of the pitch. And the entire other 19 outfield players are chasing him, and they're all kids are screaming at this kid, running, and he got towards the opposition penalty area and stopped, and he put his foot on the ball and clipped it over the goalkeeper, and I thought, what a goal. The ball bounced on the top of the bar and went over. I was gutted. To have that sort of decorum, that sort of presence of mind, and to do it, I thought, oh, I wish you'd got into that. But anyway, that's the brief one. But the one I want to sort of concentrate more on is the exact opposite of the one I mentioned first. So it's the last day of the season, and I'm sort of quite fortunate as a Chelsea fan that we've had sort of quite a few occasions where we've been sort of in the mix up to win things at the end of the season. And there's always this sort of mathematical possibility, you know, if Watford score 17 goals and Huddersfield can concede 15, the goal difference could turn around, and it's all one of those sort of, technically, there is hope. Well, yeah, okay. So, I mean, there's that sort of thing, and Dan's got this phrase you've got in there, but the last day, and how it's different for if you're sort of involved on the top or bottom, or you're just mid-table and it's sort of drifting to a natural conclusion. And the last day is divided between the many playing for nothing and the few groping for everything. The fruitless and the hopeful final day is happening at two speeds in different dimensions. Dead right. So I think that really sort of me as well. And it's all about when you almost, if you're not involved, you almost crave being involved. And I sat today with my wife, who's a Wolves fan, and we watched the semi-final. Yeah. And I mean, I'm semi-involved, but not really involved. And the joy, and then the despair at the moment. Got a pair of headphones, and I'm not listening to me, so I can't talk about it. But it's about, and football fans have this thing that non-football fans can't understand. And I always describe non-football fans as members of the MTV generation. You don't know highs, you don't know lows. Life is just a continuous form. And I think, you know, there again, and Dan's mentioned that sort of thing in that chapter, and that sort of fit for me as well. And I just think it's like it's that sort of, it's the denouement, it's the finale. And the drama is, and you almost feel disappointed. I mean, Sky was going to have something in the end, you know, the relegation decided day, or and the championship, but battle for 11th or whatever. Yeah. But it's all, you know, it's great to be involved in those things. You know, you're think that's a lost day of the season. I think that's a really good chapter. That sort of that hit on me really well.
I think the thing I enjoyed, very kind again, very much appreciate that. The thing I remember thinking through that chapter was the match of the day on the last day of the season as well. When they cut between things, I still love that. just great telly. And but you're right. I mean, it's probably just to feel like a grumpy old man, but it feels like there's been less jeopardy in recent Premier League last days. So it's become a race for fourth, or even the race for the last UEFA Europa Cup place. And it doesn't quite have the same drama. Hopefully Liverpool and your two teams will give us those neutrals something like that to enjoy a match of the day this time.
Steve's looking towards having a heart attack on the last day.
We need to get as many of these recorded as we can while we've still got him.
Yeah, I know. God, I know.
Oh, that's it. Well, that's it. If we do win it, it'll take me a week to come down off the off the hangover.
I can't say I need to go live to you, Stephen.
Actually, I'd probably still be sat on the ground, to be fair.
I'm really sorry. I'm gonna pick three, but I'll keep two of them quite brief. One, because I fully got it, and I tried to explain it to my eldest daughter, and she just thought I was being rude. So I'll come to that one in a sec. the first one is the watching in a way end erupt. Now, I love football. I love everything about football. I can find the beauty in anything in football. And when you're a sort of a home supporter in the home end and you score, that I'm not saying that, you know, it's loud, but you don't get a true indication of the noise and what it's like because it's on top of you, isn't it? But when the away end score, it's like, oh, that's, it's like atmosphere. It's like, I actually want a packed away end. I want to hear them cheer. I want them to be in the game. I want to hear what we as the home fans sound like when we score, because you don't normally get that. And the second thing about it is, you know, in the book, you talk about that there's almost that ever so slight delay where you've realised the ball's gone in, because you're behind the goal, so you know the goal's gone in. And there's that split second of silence, and then the noise just travels up the pitch and sort of hits you like a wall. And it sounds, it's devastating because you've conceded, but it's the sound of it is just, I think it's brilliant. I just love the noise.
And the spectacle, I suppose I was able to realise I liked it because I go to so many neutral games, because it's broken my heart enough being out of the Riverside. But it's the awareness, because you've been in one of those away ends. But I'll tell you, a classic example was just as we record today, the first Wolves goal. I don't know if Wembley is strictly an away game or what, but the first Wolves goal, the little delay and the noise. I know obviously there were tens of thousands of them there, so it's going to be noisy, but that was just, I got goosebumps from that goal. It was so wonderful. And when you could see in the replay people falling over each other, falling down the aisles, all of the health and safety nightmares that I so treasure about away.
Yeah, the checking of the shins.
I'll tell you what, Dan, if you thought noise at Wembley, you should be in my apartment here and sitting next to my wife. That was noisy.
So my second one, and I would love to know how you came up with this, and it's number 15, fat players. Now, I was reading this, and my eldest daughter was there, and she went, what are you reading, what are you laughing at? I went, oh, it's this book, it's great, Molly, it's all about different chapters of four. She went, like, what? I said, well, there's one about fat players, and she just looked at me and went, she said, that's awful. And I was like, no, you need to understand. She was like, no, I'm not having it. And she killed it dead. However, I think it is absolutely abstract genius as to how you even begin to come up with that. And obviously, you know, Stephen, you're the first player that popped in my head, and this is awful if he listens, and I feel really bad. I'm sure he won't be, I'm sure we're good, was Lee Trundle. He was the first player that popped into my head. Yeah, because I thought he was brilliant. I thought as a footballer, I would pay to watch him all day. But if he had to run a marathon to save my life, there's no chance.
You can't beat a talented fat player. No. They're just fantastic. You know, Jan Mouldy fitted that crowd. Often, but he wouldn't always be that big barrel. You know, he'd have seasons where he was an absolute barrel. He'd have seasons where he was, you know, fantastically, you know, in shape. But he was massively talented. You know, eye for a pass that, you know, can only compare to Xabi Alonso in Liverpool. You know, that third eye, he knew where everyone was on the pitch. But epically fat sometimes. You know, there was a brilliant, brilliant story about David Beckham's time at Real Madrid. and, you know, I was on a training pitch with a load of kind of like 15-year-olds in the youth team, and this you know, fat little fellas there on the pitch, and, you know, they were busy telling him that this player can, you know, you do absolutely anything in his time, and they're all laughing at him basically because he was short, stocky, and fat, and he proceeded to take 20 footballs and hit the crossbar with every single one of them from about 30 yards, and they were all stood there kind of like aghast, thinking, "My God, how good is he?" And it was Fennec Puskás.
Oh, you know, Stevie, you just ruined my thing. I was just say, best player ever, Ferenc Puskás. Busted,
you know,
mate.
He was like well into his 70s at the time, or, you know, pushing 80 or whatever he was. But yeah, he could still do it. And these teenagers were just, you know, absolutely stunned. But yeah, the talented fat player. Absolutely.
It was just... When did you get when exactly? But was that an early one, Dan? In your thought process?
No, I remember the game. I was at a Chester game, so they were way down then. They were in about the sixth tier of football, I think, if not lower. And there was a lad there playing for Chester who was just, and you know, that's the, it's so low down that they're all quite a lot bigger than yeah, you know, Premier League players. Well, he was particularly big, this fella, but he was absolutely brilliant. He was basically standing in the centre circle, spraying it for, like, yeah, only 40, 50 yards, absolutely, yeah, leathering it when he got near goal. And I suppose, I was going to say, fat players always seem to be good, but of course they've got to be good to make the team. For me, yeah. They've got to have something, so I suppose it goes without saying. But yeah, that happened at a Chester game, of all places, that thought.
It's brilliant. Like I said, the chap, when I got to see him and I saw it, it was the very first one that I read, because I was just like, oh my God, that's genius. Because I knew exactly what it would be about, even just from the title. But like I say, my eldest daughter was really affected by the whole thing. But that's all right. So my last one, and this is the one that I can probably relate to the most, is the Sunday Score pages. I used to spend hours over them. And I would look at, like you say, you look at the most random league tables and try and look at how close, I don't know, Evo Stick North, how tight promotion's going to be, or how, yeah, many teams are involved in the relegation battle, or how, you know, a team that maybe sits seventh hasn't lost away from home, bizarrely. But yeah, and I would just look for the most random number patterns, and like you say, in attendances, and just the number. I don't like maths, hate maths, but that page, and it's epic, especially if you got it from a broadsheet. You know, it was, yeah, just purely a page of numbers, but I would pour through every division.
I was doing it just this morning because the Sunday Times is still the best. It's just about the only reason to buy this Sunday Times. It's a full page of beauty, and my obsession with the attendances, and I don't know why it has no effect on my life whatsoever, but I just love knowing how many were at Barnet and things like that. And I don't know why, but there's an art form to it as well, to the extent that I've noticed. Just can't remember if it's on that program on Quest with the Championship highlights and the Football League highlights, but they started putting points after played, and it really winds me up more than,
yeah,
any, it winds up more than, yeah, Brexit. It's just, points at the end. Points goes at the end, and it really messes with my head. So that's how ingrained that is in me, I think.
Yeah, like I said, I think they're fascinating, and I think, you know, if you could, you know, if there's a, you know, someone struggling to engage with maths, and certainly if they, you know, if they have a love of, yeah, football, it is definitely a way, yeah, in to averages and, you know, and all sorts of mathematical permutations. They're almost like a work of art. The pages are just, yeah, like a work of art, the way they're all set out. And yeah, you're right. But points do need to be absolutely at the end. I mean, we're already 50 minutes through this. I'm devastated already. I suppose, obviously, now, you know, Dan, you know, you've written a nostalgic look back, and you've looked at present day. I mean, looking at today's game, what do you see as sort of the best and the worst, if you like, of the modern game, of today's game?
I think the best is all of those things. It retains all of that authenticity, and I've mentioned to you before that living in Scotland, And I see a lot of the authentic old game. I was at Kilmarnock v St Johnston yesterday, and it certainly isn't the Premier League era there, even though it's called the Premiership. So it, where it retains some of that authenticity, it remains the greatest sport on earth. To me, the greatest thing on earth, actually. What annoys me is the same as what annoys everyone else. It's the horrendous sums of money and the fact I just cannot relate to so much of it. It feels like a different sport at the very top, and the hype around that, the way games are, you know, in marketing language, hyped to Super Sunday and all of this stuff, and I think stop hyping everything. A vast majority of games are terrible, but we go for so many other reasons, and it's those other reasons that I remain in love with the game despite everything, really.
Stephen, I mean, we talk about this quite a lot. I know we do. You know, but for you, the best and the worst of the modern game.
Yeah, I echo what Dan said there. It's all those things. The best is all those things that are translatable, no matter what era you're in. That they will pass from one generation to another to another. You know, it's the pre-match pint. It's, you know, that pub that's near that football ground that's been there for 120 years, and that pub has remained open. You can walk past and think people were walking in there for a pint 100 years ago before going to a match in that stadium there. It might have changed, you know, dramatically, but that footprint is still there. People are still walking down the same streets to get to those stadiums in the same way. You know, it's those routines for me. You know, the fact that you can travel a long distance, yet the routine will stay exactly the same, and that's the best of it for me. You know, that's, you know, all of those old traditions that simply football, no matter how much it changes, no matter how much, you know, they want to eliminate it, they simply cannot get rid of some traditions. And the worst of it, yeah, take the, you know, squad numbers, return the back pass. You know, all of it, 1-11, you know, substitutes, you know, all of that, you know, yeah, take your pick. You know, goals being, you know, met by music in stadiums.
Oof.
You know, it's all awful.
Oh, I'm gonna ask us all another question in a minute. I'm gonna get Gary's answer first, then I'm gonna ask you all another question, and you are gonna have to answer. Gary, for you, best and worst of modern football.
Okay, well, I think it is sort of, well, there's two things I want to say. That I think it's a generational thing. Interesting to see that Dan said earlier about his going with his father and then taking his daughter. Well, I've got very similar thing. I went to football with my dad, and both me and my wife have passed on the love of football to our son and daughter. And so that's a great thing, and it's keeping the love alive. But one of the things that really sort of give me a great deal of pleasure at the moment is Gareth Southgate's approach to selecting players for England. I love the fact that it's giving youth a chance to produce. You know, it doesn't matter if you haven't played many games for your club. This guy is giving youth, talented youth, a great chance to play for England. I think it's massively refreshing. I really enjoy watching England play again now. It got to the stage where it was a bit sterile and uninspiring, but you know, I feel it's got a joy back to it again. So I want to throw that in as well. Worst things, I think there's the growing disconnect between the public and the players, inevitably because of money. But the other thing is, and people say about, you know, football is bad for society. I think it's the other way around, and I think there's a problem at the moment where football supporters, or that's probably not the right word, people who go to football game are reflecting this abhorrent populism that's sweeping across the country and part of the world at the moment, where an intolerance of people that are different, that's becoming a real major issue for me. And there's racist issues, but not just that, there's other things as well. And that intolerance, let's say, caused by this sort of populism of people like Trump and the Brexiteers, if I offend anybody, if I don't mean to, who caused this this development of hatred of otherness.
Yeah, I mean,
seriously,
that's right. That's fine. Like I say, it's open discussion. Don't worry about that. Although well done, Gary. You've actually saved the question. I am really grateful. But it seems to us three that the good things about the modern game are the traditions that are still left. And has nothing to do with that modern game. We just like the things that haven't left yet. So I suppose to Dan and Stephen, really, because you gave the answers. Is there anything, or do you have, you know, what are your sort of biggest hopes? I mean, Gary's talked about the England team and giving youth a chance, and rightly so. I loved watching England on this last international break for the first time in God knows how long. In terms of the modern game or the way the game is going, you know, what are your sort of hopes, I suppose, more than anything else? You know, do you hope that football can either change something? Are you hoping it'll do something? Or are you hoping still for it to retain something? What's your sort of big hope for the next, sort of maybe next generation, if you like?
Mine would be that if prices to get in can't go down, and I still think they can go down, especially if the telly money keeps going in the direction that gate money isn't making clubs that much money, really, but they need crowds to make it a television spectacle. So I would hope, number one, gate money goes, the price of going in comes down. However, if that doesn't happen, I hope more people drift downwards through the leagues. I know you can never leave your first team behind, I get that, but I hope there's more football tourism within England and within Scotland, and that people start getting on the bus and the train and to see the non-league club, the League Two club, or whatever. And then we'll find they do still love football, actually, because it's authentic and in its own way beautiful the lower down you get.
We've talked a little bit about that before, Stephen. When you look for, we just talked about authenticity. You know, if you really want to find authenticity now, you almost have to go down the leagues to try to find that authentic example of the game as we knew it, I suppose, as we started off in the podcast, in that sweet spot.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I was Liverpool playing Friday night, for instance, and I was driving around not far from home yesterday, about 5 o'clock, 5 to 5, passing the non-league ground, and people were streaming out, and it was just the greatest sight. It was just these people flooding the streets after a game, and you could still hear Hanoi in the distance, and it was brilliant. You know, it's just a hope that kind of, like, you know, the simplicity of you know, the love of the game remains. It's all the simple things that are the best. You know, it's those sensory moments that people will take for granted and then look back on and lament that they've lost, like we have done with these podcasts. You know, it's the things that have gone. You don't miss them until they disappear. And even then, you might not necessarily miss them for about 10 years. You'll just suddenly remember something and think, why did they stop doing that? You know, and it's just that hope that, you know, yes, you know, it remains an affordable commodity for people to be able to go and watch, but yeah, that it just retains those traditions and those simple joys. And yeah, I go with Dan as well over the, you know, people needing to kind of, like, embrace football and go beyond your own team to look at what's there and just discover what's there.
Brilliant. Gary, for you, obviously, you know, like you say, you've talked about Gareth Southgate very much in the present, but, you know, going forward, you know, as a generational thing, you know, your big hope for football?
It's difficult to sort of not say the same things that the guys have said already, because I think they're all very up for sides. It'd be great if people get a feeling of it not being theatre anymore, of it being something that they have a connection to. I mean, I think I mentioned the past, I go to my local club here in Spain who play in, it's called the Tercera Regional League, so it's like fifth level. And we went yesterday and we had a terrible season. People who were on the club and left and money disappearing, all this sort of thing. But yesterday they were scored very early, and then they were 2-1 down, and they were 4-2 up. They scored 4 goals, and that's many goals I think we've seen the team score in the entire season. They ended up then getting the centre-half injured, and he was all the subs, and conceded 2 goals in injury time. Only got a draw out of it. They're still on the relegation thing, but it's that connect we have with that team now. I mean, and there's probably, I don't know, might be 150, 250 plus people go watch, but it's real football, and it's not. I mean, I've been to many games. In fact, we've been to see Elche play a couple of times. We've already fell to us. They're playing the Segunda division here in Spain, And that's quite a similar sort of thing on a much larger scale, but it's way different to go and see Barcelona play. Barcelona's theatre, you know what's going to happen. It's like a play. You know the end result, and you applaud the magnificence of the players on the stage. But it's a theatre, and I think that the real beauty of football is the unknown. It's the unexpected. It's the ooh that springs out and grabs you that you never saw coming. So I think that's probably something I'd like to see more of, and it would happen more. People do the things that Dan and Steve mentioned there about going to more down the league clubs and stadiums.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, time is always against us, but Dan, final question for you. I really hope you've got an answer for this. Is there any more books in the pipeline that run on this format?
I hope so. I'll certainly be pitching to do one, and if I don't get a book deal, I'll write it anyway because it's not quite out of my system yet. so yes, somehow there will be.
Brilliant. That's all I needed to hear. So long as you're not saying no, then I'm okay with that. Well, like I say, it's fascinating. Like I say, I could talk to you for hours, Dan. It's such. I think the forums between are such kindred spirits. Like I say, I think it could just go on and on and on. But you know, like I say, as always, Matt, I implore anyone to purchase this book. You know, the Saturday 3 PM book, Black Boots and Football Pink. For anybody with a real love of football, you will just get it. Is probably, I know that's not a great testimony to have on the back of your book, but you'll just get it. You will from word one, you will absolutely get it. Every single chapter is an absolute gem. But Stephen, as always, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, joy as ever, Stu. Absolute joy as ever.
Brilliant. Gary, again, thank you very much for joining us from the warmer climes where you are.
Yeah, it was great fun. I really enjoyed it. And massive thanks to Dan for writing the book and giving us some joy, mighty.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, thank you, Dan. It's, like I say, you're more than welcome. Obviously, you've got to keep churning out books, but you're more than welcome to join us at any time. And if you want to join us to talk about another discussion, always, always welcome on the Lob Podcast at any time.
A lovely way to spend a Sunday, an hour on a Sunday evening, isn't it?
It is, and like I say, I can finally talk to people who get me, and that's quite important therapy for me.
It is. It's something of a self-help group.
It is. That's exactly what it is. That is exactly what it is. So all that's left for me is to thank the listeners for listening, and hope that you'll join us once again on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.